Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to a special edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Dominic Fifield of The Athletic, and, making his debut, Paul Hayward, the author and journalist. We'll begin with a statement of the obvious. Football isn't the same without fans. They leave a void emotionally and, in too many cases, financially. We wanted to pay homage to them. The result is a documentary, Ours, that airs on BT Sport 1 tomorrow night. I've tried to give an insight into the passion, the principles, and the potential of a series of clubs. Now, Paul, you feature in it when we look at Lewis, a great example of a socially conscious club. What role do you think, if any, will fans play in football's future?
Well, the first thing we'll see, Mike, is this flooding back into the game. The gates will swing open and fans will pour in with this immense sense of relief. And the clubs from top to bottom will feel the same flood of relief because fans have been missed. You know, we'll wait to see whether the players feel the same joy when they've got fans holding them to account again. But there's going to be an adding up. Clearly, there's a massive difference between the bottom end of the spectrum, where fans are needed desperately financially, in the Premier League end, where, although they've lost a fair amount of money between them, these 20 clubs, they have managed okay without fans. You know, they've kept the show on the road. But Premier League fans in particular, I think, will maybe start to view their roles. They'll stock take, if you like, and decide which bits of it they like and which bits they don't. And they've had plenty of time to think about that, certainly over the last 12 months.
Yeah. Do you think, Dom, fans actually recognise their financial power, and is their loyalty exhaustible?
Premier League level, it's debatable whether they recognise the financial clout that they have because it's broadcast rights driven, and that's what's sustaining the clubs through this period. I think that the toils of lower league clubs and non-league clubs in particular, which was illustrated brilliantly in the film, by the way, just the amount of the reliance of these clubs on supporters coming in through the gates, I think that has really been rammed home. And I think in that wave of emotion that will accompany their return, the relief that the clubs will feel will largely be born on finances, I would have thought. You know, we're finally getting people in through the gates. We're finally getting ticket prices or ticket income again, which is so key. And it, you know, knock on with sponsorships and, you know, VIP and commercial, etc. That all comes into it. I hope that this period does recalibrate the relationship between supporters and their clubs. I think even at Premier League level, a lot of fans who have been absent and have watched their teams and their clubs carrying on without them have grown immensely frustrated at certain aspects of life. It's really exacerbated any frustrations they may have, for example, with the team and the style of play that they're adopted. They've expected football to entertain them properly during this period, and on a lot of occasions it simply hasn't, because clubs have prioritised, say, for example, survival over entertainment, even more so than they would ever done, because the implications of relegation from the Premier League now are even more exacerbated than they would be normally, given the pandemic. But whether or not that actually happens and plays out, I don't know. Well, it'll be intriguing to see. I mean, some of the stories that you covered in the documentary, real eye openers at all ends, you know, from the top to bottom of the spectrum. And one image that, that struck me in particular was seeing you're going back to Nain Park and Rushden and Diamonds and seeing it derelict now. I mean, that was remarkable and not something that I'd anticipated or knew about. It's properly eye-opening stuff.
Well, I suppose that does illustrate one of the dangers that clubs face. You know, with Rushden in particular, they threw in their lot or with one individual, Max Griggs, and when his business interests overrode any football advantage that he saw from that football club on a personal level rather than a professional level, basically the football club was actually destroyed by his whims in the end. He sold it to the fans for £1 and they were eventually eliminated from the conference. I suppose on the broader issue, Paul, what are the other dangers do you feel to clubs as they emerge from the pandemic? You know, we're seeing excessive tribalism around. There's the corporatism of the game is creeping in. If we are going to have a reset, what form should that take?
Well, I think generally fans over the last decade or so have been turned into consumers, and they're expected to be passive consumers, customers. The teams and the players have become more remote. They feel like they're, you know, walking into shopping emporiums rather than clubs. There's all these very deep cultural things going on that can lead to alienation. And I think if the addiction to football in this country wasn't so strong and people didn't love the game so much, football would have a much bigger problem on its hands because it doesn't generally treat fans particularly well. I'm talking obviously in the round. There are clubs that treat their fans magnificently and they have a community sense, community spirit. But in general, I don't feel, listening and talking to fans, that they generally feel particularly valued or welcomed. You know, they have to put aside their grievances to go to football every week. And the more they express those and the more they translate that into action in terms of what, you know, what they will and won't put up with, the more football clubs are going to come to understand that they can't just treat fans as social media numbers.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, within the film, you've got a group of fans capable of leading by example at Portsmouth. You know, I'm sure that was a story you covered, Dom. You know, what are the wider lessons of what they did down at Portsmouth?
I went down to see them in 2014 and spent a couple of days down there. Andy Orford was the manager, and they were training at a park at the time. They're just getting the planning permission for their new training ground, but it was very much, you know, rocking up at the local park in vans with all the kit in and the balls, and the players would all turn up in their cars, and it was like a Sunday league setup, but it was still really refreshing given everything that had preceded it. I think at the time they still had to pay something like £8 million to 21 former players from that era, from the era when they, you know, getting to FA Cup finals regularly and competing in the Premier League. And what they achieved at Pompey was astonishing, even though it was accompanied with the team dropping down the divisions and into the bottom tier. I think it felt cleansed of all the bogus owners, let's be honest. I mean, again, you go into that in the film, but when you actually see it all listed out in front of you, all these people that own the club and you wonder why they bothered to buy Portsmouth Football Club, and it just became an asset stripping exercise for so many different people. You can see in that context why fan ownership worked so well at Pompey. But the flip side of that was it only took them so far in terms of climbing back up the divisions, and there were obviously Portsmouth fans wanted to compete at the highest level they possibly could, and even those guys in the boardroom from the Supporters Trust recognised that there was a ceiling to what they could achieve. And so when Eisner came in and the money was thrown at them, they had that awkward choice to make. You know, do we give up what we've built here because we think this is a safer ownership structure than what we've experienced previously, and it can take us to that next level? Or do we carry on and compete at the level we're at now? And they went with the former option, and I think it probably was a sensible one. And it's, I don't know how far it'll take them, but, you know, this is a club that's now competing regularly to get out of League One into the Championship. And you know, a club of that size with that supporter base should be in the Championship at the very, very least. But it, as an exercise, it was life-affirming. It was emotional to actually be around that club at the time and to see those supporters relishing the fact that this was their club again. They trusted the people in the boardroom to take them forwards, as opposed to the mismanagement that they'd had for years at the Premier League level.
What about the broader impact of football clubs in, you know, in a social sense, Paul? You speak in the film of your, you know, affiliation to Lewis and the principles that they espouse. Is that a sustainable model?
Yeah, I was going to say, Mike, despite the slight negativity of what I said earlier, I'm incredibly lucky because where I live in Brighton, my local Premier League team is a model club in many ways. It's run by a pure benefactor who's put hundreds of millions of pounds of his own money into the club. It's a club with a strong community awareness. It's very rooted in the town, and people appreciate that. And then 5 miles up the road, I've got Lewis, which is the first club to pay their women's and men's teams equally, as you explained so well in the film. So in a sense, you know, I've got ideal models at both ends of the scale there. So it is possible. It is possible for football clubs to be run in the interests of their supporters. Obviously, money is always going to be paramount, and it's a dog-eat-dog world in so many ways. But again, going back to your film, there's so much room for encouragement there. You realise that it doesn't have to be a smash-and-grab exercise. It doesn't have to be a playground for asset strippers and speculators, you know, and fans have this power that perhaps they don't realise they actually have to save and restore their own football clubs.
Do you think, Don, there's scope for greater innovation the lower down the pyramid that you go? You know, I'm thinking of new models are emerging. You know, we look at hashtag, you know, the group of YouTubers called the Sidemen who've become involved with Leighton Orient. They are offering the opportunity to attract a whole new audience, aren't they?
Yeah, it's astonishing. I know I'm showing my age, really, but I didn't know about the Sidemen or hashtag. I was blissfully unaware of my club as well, which was obviously less successful at Ebbsfleet. But my word, I mean, the hashtag thing is incredible. I mean, it's an interesting one because football traditionally has always been about, it's always had that local community spirit at the heart of it. I mean, that's what it was all about, and it grew from that. And this is something, as you make the point in the film, that this is actually throwing it out to a wider audience first, and then almost coming in on itself to find a local hub. And there has to be room for innovation like that. Absolutely. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, whether it could ever become a league phenomenon, I have my doubts, but I do think in terms of social media and YouTube and those platforms, I mean, clubs have to embrace stuff like that now. They have to. It's I'm someone who's left a traditional newspaper to go and work for basically an app. I should be all over this stuff. I'm still learning all the time. It's you have to embrace this innovation and hashtag United and the Sidemen have shown the way in football. Look, I don't know how far you can take it, but you know, I suspect that the people that are setting this stuff up don't think along traditional boundaries. They probably feel as if they can take it as far as they want to take it.
Yeah, I suppose we do overlook the fact that the professional game, as we know it, is essentially a Victorian invention. And I suppose then that begs the question, Paul, what shape do you think football will take in the future? Will we see a divergence between, you know, a Super League type model and a community club model? You know, what role, for instance, will fan-run clubs play? And what are the pros and cons of that?
Yeah, I mean, if you were starting football clubs up now, you wouldn't follow the Victorian model, would you? And if you look at every other industry, the ownership model has evolved constantly. Actually, funny enough, when I was researching my book on the England men's football team, I discovered that a lot of the founding fathers, the early FA kind of older men, didn't believe that an individual should own a football club. They thought it was anathema to them, that a football club was a community institution, and it wasn't there to be picked off by a rich local businessman. So there was actually a much stronger community spirit in the Victorian times around football than people probably would expect. But obviously then it evolved into a business and a business opportunity. And now it's a mass globalized entertainment form. So yes, Mike, I mean, we're going to end up with some kind of European Super League one way or another. And we're going to end up with community clubs that are forced to come up with new and innovative means to survive and prosper. And until I watched your film, I hadn't realised what the possibilities were. It never occurred to me really that I knew about fans groups getting together and saving clubs at Portsmouth and places like that, and indeed at Brighton, my local club. But I hadn't really thought very much, as Dom just said, about the possibility of starting from fresh with a completely new model and saying, right, how are we going to invent a football club, you know, in the kind of digital age? And it really did open my eyes to the possibility that football's got a kind of new and more interesting future, and it's not just doomed to be sort of polarized and, you know, impoverished at the lower ends.
Yeah, when you look at international football, as you have been, Paul, what role do you think supporters play with the England team? And my sense is that there is not apathy is too strong a word, but international football seems to be just merging into the margins a little bit. Do you think fans care about the national team as much as they did?
I've noticed that as well. I think it's based on the size and the power and the addictiveness of the Premier League. And when international football comes along, this is non-tournaments. Tournaments are fine. Everybody becomes English then and gets behind the team and wants to see them win it. But in between times, you're right, international football is in danger of being seen as an interruption to the Premier League, you know, diet of thrills and spills. And that is a problem, particularly in England, where the Premier League, I think, is more pervasive than any other major league in any other country, possibly. I mean, Spain might, you know, take issue with that, with La Liga. But ultimately, England are having to fight for space and fight for attention in a way that is well, it's been happening for about, I'd say, about 15, 20 years, possibly. And it's a challenge. But in the tournaments, the England team belongs to everybody. It becomes a national sensation. And as we know, when England got to the World Cup semi-final in Russia, I think 26 million people watched that game against Croatia. So the affection is still there. It's just become buried somewhat by Premier League and Champions League action.
Yeah, if we're looking at the epitome of the modern model, Dom, we're looking at Manchester City. You know, it's an expanding global model. They're almost becoming consultants now to other clubs. Is there a point that they will reach, probably very soon, that they will become too powerful for the common good? I realise that could be a hospital pass for question, so I apologise in advance for asking it.
Yeah, rival supporters will say so, yeah, definitely. And you could have the same argument, I guess, about PSG in France and Qatari influence there. I would say that a more positive spin is it demands the other elite clubs, whether they're backed by oligarchs or rival states or big groups from America, it demands that they find a way of making inroads still, of they find a way of eclipsing Manchester City and their vast wealth and talent. And look at, you know, it's easy to, I mean, we should really be focusing on what's happening on the pitch in terms of Manchester City. I mean, given that they're probably achieving, even by their standards, something absolutely remarkable this season. But we don't know what's going to happen, you know, the day that Pep Guardiola leaves Manchester City. We don't know whether there would be a period of readjustment that would offer other teams and other clubs an opportunity to come in there and take their crown. I mean, it's not as if Manchester City have enjoyed it all their own way in the last few years either. They weren't even champions last season. So, you know, it's the economic model obviously is very difficult to compete against, but on the pitch, it is possible to beat them on occasion, as much as 20 league wins or 20 wins in all competitions would suggest otherwise. So there is hope, but it's the onus is on the elite. And I said it, you know, I think we all said it when it looked as if Abramovich's money was going to dominate the Premier League. Well, it did, but then Manchester United found a way of beating them, and then Manchester City emerged. I think that football at that elite level will continue to attract money from owners or states or hedge funds or whatever that will make life interesting in terms of what happens on the pitch.
Mm. Speaking of being on the pitch, Paul, what about the evolution of this team, the Pep Guardiola's team? Is it almost, because it's beautiful, it's, you know, some of the football that they play is beautiful. Is this team almost Pep's final masterpiece before he retires?
It's looking that way, but it's funny, isn't it? Because not that long ago, 6 months ago maybe, people were saying, oh, this is the end of the Guardiola experiment. It's run its course. You know, they can't win the Champions League. Liverpool have become the dominant force in English football. And it looked as if a very good idea had run out of steam. But it's regenerated itself, partly because Liverpool have fallen away, admittedly. But he's moved it on, and they are playing a less kind of Barcelona-esque style now, I would say. They're more direct and functional in a good way. They're still beautiful to watch. But, you know, if there's one part of a team where you can't be successful in if you haven't got it right, is at centre-back. And they found a centre-back pairing to completely stabilise the attacking end of the team. They didn't have that before. And sometimes we look for complex explanations, and sometimes they're actually quite simple. If you get the back of the team sorted out so that it has, what, 16 clean sheets, I think, or something, Manchester City? Mm. Yeah. When you give the attacking players that kind of platform, then you're back in business. And it also helps if your closest rival, Liverpool, slightly implode.
What do you think? Chelsea's a club you know well, Dom. What do you think would happen to that club if Roman Abramovich's personal circumstances changed? Would it be forced to maybe rely on the academy as a source of consistent talent rather than the cash cow?
Well, we're told that there are contingency plans in place, and if something did happen and the source of funding that is there at the moment that allowed them to spend over £200 million last summer was withdrawn overnight, that actually they would survive. They wouldn't suddenly be, you know, up the Swanee. But he has built the infrastructure up. I mean, let's be honest. So they do have one of the best, if not the best, academies in the country. So if that running that actually is probably, I don't know, it's probably the equivalent of one of their elite players' annual wage to actually run that place. So the basis, again, the foundation is in place for them to survive. Yeah, I mean, obviously it would temper expectations and their targets would shift overnight as well, but the talent is there, and the locally nurtured talent is very much present. And it's, I mean, that was one of the greatest benefit of the Lampard tenure as manager was to bring through and offer opportunities to players like Mason Mount and Reece James, etc., Tammy Abraham, and these guys have got the talent to thrive. We're not at that stage yet with Abramovich, but you know, that's sort of been hovering. That possibility has always been there, and I guess it's there with any elite club that the money might suddenly be withdrawn overnight.
Yeah, well, as a case in point, Wolves are at the Etihad on Tuesday night. Do you think, Paul, they might be vulnerable to a shift in Chinese government policy? We know all too well that football doesn't exist in a vacuum, either socially, medically, or politically. And it's interesting, these warning signs that are coming from China, the Super League champions there, Jiangsu, have ceased operations. Their owners, who also own Inter Milan, who still owe Manchester United 51 million euros for Lukaku. You're looking at a bit of a knock-on effect there if they basically default on that. Wolves, are they vulnerable as well?
Well, I can see why the Chinese league, the idea of a Chinese Super League, is vulnerable, because that's a very domestic proposition. Without Champions League football, if you can't get into the Champions League, you can't go anywhere in a Chinese Super League. You can have a very entertaining local spectacle, but it doesn't really translate globally, does it? So I can understand why the future for Chinese investors in football would be abroad, and particularly in the Premier League, and that's what we've seen with Wolves. But you're right, Mike. I mean, that's a very volatile situation, and you know, things change politically, business priorities change, and you always slightly worry about a club that has, you know, so many of its chips on one square at the roulette table. Once those chips are taken away, you could be in trouble very, very quickly. I mean, Wolves fans, I'm sure, have enjoyed the ride, and they're enjoying watching a higher class of player than they've probably seen since the, you know, 1950s, I suppose. But they will know that it is provisional, it is tenuous.
Just want to get back to being on the pitch, Dom. Staying with Chelsea, probably. Thomas Tuchel, is he meeting his KPIs?
I think he's probably done all that we could have expected of him. I think, again, he's done very, very well in terms of providing a structure, a defensive foundation upon which Chelsea can build. They're obviously a lot more organised now than they were over that 6 to 8 week period where it all unravelled for Lampard. There seems to be a strategy at play now in terms of the players knowing what is expected of them out on the pitch. I think certain aspects around the club, the communication, talking to people at Chelsea, they're suggesting that it's a lot more open, as you'd expect probably from a new manager coming into a job, to be honest. I mean, he's got to get people on side from the off. He's inherited a club that and a squad that was underachieving for a period of time, but we could all see that the talent was there. And I think he's done as well as anyone could have expected to do. I mean, this is the test. This run of games is a true test. When they go to, I mean, there was a wonderful result in Bucharest against Atletico Madrid, a solid point against Manchester United, when they probably came away feeling a bit disappointed, in fairness, on Sunday. They've now got the two Liverpool clubs, Liverpool and Everton, two Merseyside teams who will provide a real test of where Chelsea are at. And then Atletico Madrid, and then I'd include Leeds away just because of their pitch, to be honest, because that is such a leveller. It's such a difficult surface on which to play. So once we've emerged from those fixtures, we'll have a better idea of how much true progress Tuchel has instigated at Chelsea. But I do think that he just got a very canny manager who knows what he's doing. And he's made the impact that you'd expect him to make at a club that had bag full of talent, but had lost its way in terms of structure.
Mm. What do you make of Manchester United, Paul? They're 12 points behind City after that goalless draw at Chelsea. What do they need to go to the next level, do you think?
Well, after the 0-0 draw with Chelsea, Sky flashed up a board of Manchester United's results against top six opponents since they got hammered 6-1 at home by Spurs. It's 4-0 draws in a row against top six opposition. So what that tells you is that 6-1 defeat to Spurs left a real imprint on them, and they don't want to go through that again. They're trying to avoid it. So against teams of comparable quality, they're playing with a lot more caution than an Alex Ferguson Manchester United team would have played. And that's understandable in a way, because I think Manchester United are trying to make some, you know, big leaps forward, and you can't make them all in one go. It's a process. I would look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's team and say that most of what he's doing looks absolutely correct and spot on, you know. But it's not a linear process, and they're not going to get to challenging Manchester City in the time frame that they've had, given that they made so many bad buys and made so many bad decisions in the transfer market, most of which they're still trying to correct. But there's the essence of a very good team there. It's just a bit inconsistent and it lacks conviction when it's up against a top class opponent. But it's all progress as far as I can see.
Has the nature of that club changed, you know, since the days, you know, you wrote an acclaimed book with Sir Alex Ferguson? His imprint was on that club for more than two decades. Has the nature of the football club changed since?
Well, I think it has. I think what happened was, obviously, the Glazers bought Manchester United because they thought it was an undervalued brand. And they thought they could sweat more money from the brand. And all they were interested in really was doing deals. It was a deal-making factory. And the playing side took care of itself because they had Sir Alex Ferguson as manager. He went and then they started making sort of snap decisions on managers and lurching around and sacking managers and making bad decisions in the transfer market. But what seems to have happened, I think, is that they've realised they're actually in danger of undermining this cash cow that they bought, and that the playing side had to be stabilised. So they've started to make better decisions again. They've started to think of the playing side as actually the most important part of Manchester United and not just a sideshow, you know, to the deal making. And I think, to be fair to them, it's starting to have an effect. They've got better people in place. They've got a manager that they've kept faith with, even though a lot of people were saying he should be sacked because he was too inexperienced. And on the pitch now, you look at them and start to think, well, they look like Manchester United again. They're not as good as the Ferguson teams and they're inconsistent. And you can see the flaws in them. But at least it feels a bit more like a football club again than it did 3 or 4 years ago.
I suppose we're looking at two things, aren't we, Dom, there? They probably need to breed the mentality to win the biggest games, which might not be there. And also, are they in danger of overburdening Bruno Fernandes, who, you know, by any measure is one of the signings of the last year or so? Because without him firing, there's not a lot of creativity there, is there?
No, it's, you know, they're not like a Manchester City that is creating chances for, you know, even the goalkeeper is setting up goals with City, whereas United, it all seems to funnel through Bruno Fernandes at the moment, and which makes the decision to start him in the Europa League tie against Sociedad last week all the more baffling, because just give this guy a bit of a break now and again. I thought he looked jaded against Chelsea at the weekend, but that's probably because N'Golo Conte was all over him, and that was one of the tactical battles that Tuchel won that day, albeit potentially at a cost for some of Chelsea's attacking play. Yeah, I mean, I think that just shows you where United are. I think they probably are the second best team in the division, and that's with Fernandes firing. But if they want to topple Manchester City at the moment, they're going to need a few other options for goals and creation to relieve that burden on one player. But, you know, the problem is they're up against an exceptional team. And last year, they were up against two exceptional teams because Liverpool were excellent. And you'd imagine that Liverpool come back again next season. They find a way of restoring some of their glitz and glamour from last year. So it's part of the evolution of Solskjaer's side. It'll be interesting to see how they attack the transfer market in the summer.
Do you get the feeling that because Solskjaer can't always quite trust his centre-backs 100%, and indeed his goalkeeper sometimes, because David De Gea is not the goalkeeper he was, that he has to play, or he feels he has to play more kind of defensive screening midfielders than he would really want to, and that contributes to the problem you've just mentioned, Don, the lack of creativity in midfield? He's got too many kind of, not journeyman midfield players, but ball-winning and you know, screening players. And he likes to play a front three, obviously, so that limits his options in terms of creative players. I mean, Donny van der Beek's the obvious example to go and play with Bruno Fernandes and take some of the creative pressure on him, but they don't seem to quite rate him yet, do they?
So, Dom, United are at Selhurst Park on Wednesday. How can a club like Palace compete in a modern Premier League?
Well, that's a really good question. And this is a club, incidentally, that is backed by two multi-millionaires, if not billionaire owners, from the United States, who have, I would argue,
almost been a bit reluctant to part with their cash in recent times. So I don't know whether the 2010 CPFC ownership looks at what Harris and Blitzer have done at Crystal Palace and are disappointed with the level of investment that's come in. But I would suggest that the supporters have been a bit dismayed by the way things are going. I mean, just look at things like net spend. You know, I hate having going down that road. And Palace's wage bill is onerous and substantial, and they haven't rejuvenated their squad in a particularly clever way in recent times. But they don't spend money. They don't spend money. I mean, look at, you know, Brighton, for a prime example. Brighton have probably spent about five times as much money as Crystal Palace in the last three or four years. They're comfortably the lowest spenders on transfer fees in the division. So to compete, I mean, what is competition for Crystal Palace? It's probably being in mid-table and pushing up towards the top half and maybe thinking about Europa League qualification. Well, you could argue that Roy Hodgson, without any budget to spend in the market, has achieved mid-table. It hasn't been pretty to watch. None of it's been pretty to watch, really, apart from a spell when they had Johan Kabay and Ruben Loftus-Cheek in their midfield a few seasons back. But it's really effective. And I, for one, completely admire the way that Hodgson tackles it. I mean, even at the moment, when we, you know, like, Palace won't get anything out of United and Spurs in the next two games, but the reality was they needed to get at least 4 points from their previous two games, and they did somehow. So now they're in a position where they've got the most points they've ever had in the Premier League after 26 matches. So it's and I think it's only the top five and Arsenal have got more points than them in the calendar year. So you can't really complain too much at that.
But there was that sense, given the way that the relegation battle is contracting, that Fulham missed the chance against them on Sunday. Do you agree with that, Paul?
Possibly, but I think that Fulham are playing well and they're picking up points, and they've gone from being a team that looked doomed quite quickly to being one that knows what it's trying to do. It's got a very good manager. Scott Parker has got them organised and working and enthusiastic. They're certainly not a team who've given up on the idea of staying in the Premier League. And they're making ground on Newcastle and Brighton. So although there'll be individual games where you say, oh, well, Fulham could have got more from that game, overall, their sort of recovery, second half of the season recovery, is going very, very well. And I bet those players will turn up at the training ground thinking, you know, we can stay in the Premier League if we do the right things. Carry on doing the right things, I should say.
Yeah, we've got Spurs at the Cottage on Thursday, Dom. Gareth Bale getting due respect at last?
Yeah, he'd probably argue he's getting an opportunity at last to get some game time and rhythm. He was outstanding against Burnley, but I suspect that Fulham will be far harder to break down. Fulham's revival, has been born on a solid defence. That was the first thing that Parker put in place. And the arrivals of Tosin and Anderson, in particular at centre-half, have been revelatory. Those two have provided them with this platform from which they have this survival bid ongoing. And they've added a bit of bite. And it's great to see Loftus-Cheek, you know, back approaching something close to his best and marauding forward. And I think they'll test Spurs. I think there'll be a proper test of them this week. And we'll see a better indication of where Tottenham are. You know, when you score in the first minute against Burnley and then their entire game plan gets wrecked, it's easy thereafter for a team like Spurs that have got the pace and the class of a Bale, and certainly of a Son and a Kane. But if Fulham keep it tight, I think Fulham will be testing that back line of Tottenham's as well, and it could be a, I mean, look, if Fulham win that match, then it really is, they've got a real chance of staying up.
Mm. Burnley have got Leicester at Turf Moor on Wednesday, Paul. As far as Leicester are concerned, what were the warning signs in that defeat by Arsenal, above and beyond the very sad loss of Harvey Barnes and also seeing Johnny Evans limp off?
Well, they were a bit too easy to play against. And, you know, Arsenal seemed to be able to turn it on against Leicester, which was a bit worrying. They seemed to be cut open too easily. And obviously, if Leicester are going to finish in the top four, they can't be that easy to score against at home, even though Arsenal, that was a particularly good Arsenal performance where they got the taste for it and started moving the ball around sweetly and finishing well. So, you know, they ran up against a good team on the day, but it's hard work for Leicester because they are overachieving in some ways. The advantages they have are that they've got a superb manager, in my view. I think Brendan Rodgers is an excellent manager. And they have this brilliant recruitment system where they keep finding good players and are able to integrate them quickly and well. But you can see it's a strain for them to be in those top four positions. And they will have bad days. Equally, they'll have days when they look like they could win the league again, as they did so miraculously not too long ago.
I suppose we can't get away from the physical demands of what's a unique season. That was their 15th game of the year on Sunday, Dom. You know, as I mentioned, they lost Harvey Barnes and Johnny Evans. Injuries are going to be a problem for them. You know, you look at someone like, you know, Wesley Fofana, who to me looked to be the outstanding young player of the season, but he hasn't played since, what, January?
Yeah, that's what happened to them last year as well. They got to a point where they were ensconced in the top four. They looked as if that they were destined for Champions League football, and then, you know, the likes of Maddison were injured, and Ndidi was injured, Pereira was injured, and they couldn't really cope with the loss of so many key players through a rush of fixtures, and as you say, the scheduling is relentless. I suppose at least if there is a consolation, they have gone out of the Europa League now, so that's one competition that they're not have to worry about in terms of the weeks ahead. Although I don't suppose that Brendan Rodgers will see that as a consolation at the moment, but they're still in the FA Cup, that they have a rush of games, and once again, that squad is being stretched. And I feel sorry for them. I think they've been brilliant for the last 2 years up until the last 10 games, really. And I just hope it doesn't happen to them again, that it all catches up. But that's, I guess, when you're competing against clubs with greater squad depth and who are able to rotate their players more, it's just the peril of the brutal nature of the Premier League at the top level. I mean, it could easily catch up with them and overwhelm them over the weeks to come. But I just hope they find a way of maintaining that lofty position, because they certainly merit it. Some of the football they played this season has been excellent.
Mm. But you know, you were right, I think, Paul, to actually hail Arsenal's performance. It capped a pretty good week for Mikel Arteta. You know, coming from behind late on in the Europa League in an unfamiliar stadium. And you had players of whom there were doubts, Nicolas Pepe, Willian in particular, doing very well. What do you make of Mikel Arteta and his very rapid evolution as a coach? Because, you know, when we think about it, he's only been there a year.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say is that if Mikel Arteta can't make a difference at Arsenal, they might as well give up, because he's doing most of the right things. He's bringing through young players, looking after them well, developing them. He's getting some of the passengers on the move, and he's asking them to play, I think, a very industrious, busy, high-energy style where they hunt the ball back and hunt in packs and work the way the other top teams in the Premier League do. And for a long time, Arsenal players just weren't prepared to do that. You know, you'd get little flashes of brilliance from them in games, but too often you'd see them walking around. They didn't have the intensity, the leadership, the industry to compete at the very top level. And there were signs in that Leicester game, not only with the kind of lovely attacking play, but there were signs in the way that they went hunting the ball back and pressing the opposition and taking their jobs really seriously, that he's getting into their heads at last and making them realise that if they want to be a successful team, they're going to have to work at it.
Yeah, you know, I want to go almost back to the start of the programme when we talked, Dom, about, you know, the void left by fans. Liverpool had a much-needed win against Sheffield United. I've been wondering over the last couple of weeks. Obviously, the injuries have been catastrophic for them. But do certain clubs, you know, an emotionally charged club like Liverpool, for instance, does that sort of club have an inherent disadvantage when they have to play in empty stadiums?
Am I getting all the hospital passes today? I know what you mean, and obviously Liverpool fans will argue that it's the case, but every single club out there has reason to say that the absence of supporters has hurt them and hurt their... Even clubs with deplorable home records, like my own, can say, actually, it's... I mean, look, Palace's one really, really excellent performance this season was in the second half against Tottenham Hotspur, where there were 2,000 home supporters standing or sitting behind that goal, bellowing them on. And you could say the same for Fulham. Fulham had 2,000 fans in the Cottage when they played Liverpool, the reigning champions, and they got a 1-1 draw that sparked their revival and gave them the belief that they could stay in the division. Every club out there has lost its 12th man, to use a cliche. I mean, I'm not having that one club should have it, bemoan the absence of supporters more than any other. I mean, even Arsenal, you know, the library and all those criticisms, they would be far more of a more daunting prospect to have, even to having 2,000 fans within the Emirates than they are with none. And they miss them. And all these, the fans desperately miss being there. They're having to watch this entire season disenfranchised, away from it all. And I suspect that's why some of the social media reactions are more knee-jerk than they've ever been. They're more volatile than they've ever been, because people don't feel as if they're part of it at the moment. They don't feel as if they're able to express their frustrations at a 0-0 draw at home to Fulham or a 7-0 home defeat to Liverpool. They can't vent their spleen in any other way, and I just can't wait for that moment to go full circle, as Paul said in his opening answer, just opening the doors of these stadiums. I've been looking forward to that moment since March last year. The tidal wave of emotion that will go into every single football ground from top tier to non-league when supporters are allowed back in and we get something approaching normality and you clear your throat and you bellow a chant and you celebrate a goal, celebrate a tackle, celebrate just being there.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really struck me about doing the film. We went up to Bury, and I've never heard a fan talk so cogently and emotionally and impressively about what his football club meant to him than James Bentley, who essentially lost his football club. Bury FC kicked out of the Football League. He's aligned himself with the Phoenix Club, Bury AFC. It is still a sadly poisonous atmosphere there. It's pitched fan against fan. But I suppose what it brought home to me, Paul, was the intrinsic role that a football club can have in the lives of ordinary fans.
Yeah, and one of the features, obviously, of the last 12 months has been the loss of social contact on an individual level. You know, a lot of people have lost their friendships or networks. I'm talking person to person, face to face. And what the film does, it makes you realise how many people have drawn social contact and friendship and a sense of belonging from going to a football club. So it's really played into the experience of the last 12 months, this problem of loneliness and isolation that we've had as a result of the COVID, various COVID lockdowns. And you saw there the Bury fans saying that this is where I go, this is where I've always been, to see familiar faces, to have friendly conversations, to feel part of something, to feel like I belong. And it was very powerful, that, because that had been taken away from him because Bury had collapsed, not in this case because of COVID, but it made me realise that there'd be a lot of fans of functioning clubs who are going to walk back into those stadiums and say to themselves, you know, thank God I'm back among my friends.
I suppose a final question for you both. How optimistic are you for the future of the game?
Dom, you're the hospital pass specialist, so you can take that one as well.
I just think football finds a way of surviving, and that will continue. It may look different. It may have new innovations as some of the things that you just described. There may be more hashtag Uniteds out there, that type of thing. But for the vast majority of football fans, it will still remain, as Paul says, about going with your mates to games and enjoying each other's company in the context of a football match. Going back to that Palace Spurs game, I have a video of that I'd captured off the television of my brother, my best mate, and his best mate sitting behind the goal when Jeffrey Schlupp scores the equaliser, and seeing them all celebrate manically and wildly as if it was like a normal scenario and they weren't socially distanced with about three seats in between each other was just a wonderful flashback towards a bit of emotional normality it felt like a bygone era. It was only a year ago, but that I've been clinging to that, and I want to see that again as soon as possible in a rammed football stadium.
I won't dodge the question completely. I'd say that if I could just pay a debt of gratitude to football. Do you remember when they said it could come back? They thought the nation would need a lift and we'd need something to look at. We'd need some live drama because, you know, theatre and cinema had, you know, gone down the pan. That promise has been fulfilled, really, and football will have kept a lot of people going, you know, in terms of just being able to look at something that's unscripted and it's every night, certainly every night, there's an excitement level still there even without crowds. There's a story, there's a narrative. I just think football has done a wonderful job of giving us something to look at, talk about, and, you know, feel part of, even though most people have been on the outside looking in.
Yeah, well, in the film, I admit that I'd fallen out of love with the game's elitism and greed. Meeting so many good people, doing the right things for the right reasons, renewed my faith in football. It made me think like a fan again, which I suppose can't be a bad thing. Is it time for fans to reclaim the game, to use that cliche? Well, I probably think so. What do you think? Please let me know. In the meantime, thanks to Paul and Dom, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.